So at our church, one of the things that we do is I try to plan out the sermons a few months at a time, and so I'll kind of have the titles and the scriptures and where everything's going to fall ready a little bit in advance, and then it comes around to the week of the message, and I sometimes look at it and go, why did I pick this? What in the world am I going to say about this? I was looking at this passage and this past week, and I looked at it and I said, you know, it deals with persecution. It deals with kind of how we face persecution, and I don't really know what to say to our congregation about that. But it reminded me that sometimes there in life, we will encounter things where we don't know exactly what to say. We don't know exactly how to give an answer to something. I'll give you an example of that. Back in what seems like a former life now, I was working at a church as an associate pastor, and part of my role was to lead a youth choir tour every summer. And if you've ever led a youth trip, you'll know what I'm about to say. If you've never led a youth trip and children aren't your thing, let me know and let Rob Simmons, our student director, know, and we could probably plug you in somewhere to work with some youth. But when you're a youth leader, the morning time becomes a game of 20 questions. On these youth choir tours, we would go to all these different places around the country. We went to Boston one year, Philadelphia, we did New York, we did Washington, D.C., we did St. Louis, Memphis, New Orleans, Miami, all over the map. And you know, everywhere we would go, there would be questions that the kids would have. And the 20 questions would go something like this. You're sitting in the hotel lobby, trying to enjoy a peaceful breakfast, and everyone's coming up to you and asking, what are we doing today? What do we need to wear? What do we need to bring with us? I mean, you just kind of came to expect that. That was what you were going to experience on those mornings of those trips. Well, one year, I had decided that I was going to do something a little interactive to keep them occupied during some of the monotony of the travel. And so on their t-shirt that was for the trip, we had built in a word search. And the word search was such that they would encounter different clues along the way. And one morning, one of the kids in the group came up to me at breakfast and said, I think I figured out the answer. I said, okay. She said, the answer is Jesus. To which I looked at her and responded kind of cheekily. I said, the answer is always Jesus. You know, just kind of, that's a good pastoral response to give in the moment. Of course, the answer is always Jesus. That's what VBS is about this year. The answer is always Jesus. Well, just as soon as I said that, I realized we had someone eavesdropping on our conversation. A man sitting at the high top next to us spins around real fast and he goes, Jesus is the answer, huh? Oh yeah? Well, do I have some questions for you? To which I did what any responsible adult would do in that moment. I've quickly turned to the kids in our youth group and I said, children, to your rooms, now, go, get ready. And I proceeded to engage with this man who clearly had an agenda in trying to answer some of the questions he had about the faith. As I listened to him talk, I could kind of hear the kind of snarky, kind of condescending tone that he had. And I could pick out the different tropes that I'd heard before. I could tell you the different authors that I was pretty sure that he had read and which bookstores he shopped at. And he had these questions of the faith, and it just reminded me, as I sat there and tried to patiently and calmly answer everything as best as I could, that sometimes we don't know exactly what to say when it comes to talking about matters of the faith. And I realized in that moment that I could cover as much as I wanted to. I could have the best arguments. And for this guy, I'm not sure it was going to be enough. I'm not sure I was going to do much convincing. It was going to take a deeper work of the Spirit, a deeper move of God for something to change within his life. But it reminded me as I was looking back over this passage this week that there are different times in our lives that we need to know what we believe and where we stand. We need to know how to act in those moments. We need to know the answers that we will give. We need to know when questions come our way, how we will respond to it. As we've been moving through the series, we started it last week, and we're kind of looking at the different churches that the letters of Revelation were written to. So chapters 2 and 3 of Revelation are seven different letters to seven different churches that were all prominent in the first century of Christianity. and they kind of form like a little mail route. I've got a map that you probably can't see too well, but maybe you can go online later and look at the live stream and see this a little more closely. But Ephesus was the first one we looked at last week. It's kind of in the bottom left corner of that group there in Asia Minor, and then Smyrna's kind of diagonally right above it. And then we'll just kind of go in a loop. That's the way that the letters go. They just kind of go in what would have been like a mail circuit for someone in the first or second century, and they would have kind of traveled along those places. They're all in modern-day Turkey, all a part of Asia Minor as it was known at the time. And all of these communities were communities where they were experiencing challenges of standing up for the Christian faith. And the one in Smyrna is certainly no doubt is one where they were dealing with persecution, they were dealing with struggle. And so our key question for today is this: what does true faith cost us? What does it mean for us to stand up and to stand firm in our faith in the midst of that? So we look at this passage, there are a few things we can kind of unpack within this that kind of share with us how we stand up for our faith, what our true faith looks like, and what it might cost us in our life. We begin, and it kind of sets the context here in this first verse. It says, verse 8, to the angel of the church in Smyrna write, these are the words of him who is the first and last, who died and came to life again. Now, we pause right there for just a moment, also for the ambulance to go by. It always happens when I'm talking. But Jesus here is the one speaking. He's the one giving these words to the church in Smyrna. And he identifies himself as the first and the last, and also the one who died and came to life again. Now, when we read that, we would think, okay, yes, Jesus died on the cross. He was raised from the dead. He could have said that to any of these churches. That was an easy way for him to identify it. But it's significant that he chooses to use it here. He uses it here more than likely because Smyrna was a community, was a city that had experienced its own resurrection. It had laid dormant for three centuries after it had been destroyed and left abandoned. But then, through a matter of circumstance, it kind of rose in prominence again to the point of the book of Revelation. It was one of the most prosperous cities within Asia Minor. So how did that happen? They experience a little bit of their own resurrection of being dead and then coming to life again. In other words, Jesus is making a connection there. He's making a connection with this group of, I know what it's like to feel as though you have gone away and then to come back. But for Jesus, it had a deeper meaning. It had the meaning of hope embedded within it. And that meaning of hope is one that's going to be woven throughout this conversation with the church in Smyrna as a theme that will cement what he's calling them to do and how he is calling them to stand in the moment that they find themselves. We get a little bit of a sense of what that moment looks like when we jump to the next verse. I know your afflictions and your poverty, yet you are rich. I know about the slander of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Now, we need to pause right there and just kind of understand what's going on here. So in the first century, everyone was under Roman occupation. And the way that the Roman government worked was they expected people to worship the emperor or from the pantheon of the Roman gods. They were pluralistic. They had a pantheon of gods. And you can choose to worship anywhere within that and worship the emperor, the Caesar as well. But there were certain ancient traditions, like the Jewish faith, where they had kind of an ancient legacy. And so the Jewish people were known as this ancient faith, this ancient group that worshiped this one true God. And because of that, they were kind of grandfathered in. And so the Romans didn't really mess with the Jews. They said, you've got your own God, that's fine. Just keep doing what you're doing. You've done it for a long time. But for the Christians, what the Christians came in and said was that they too were a part of that lineage. They were a part of that Jewish faith, but they were the fulfillment of it. They had encountered the Messiah in Jesus Christ, and because they had encountered the Messiah in Jesus Christ, that meant that it was a fulfillment of everything that the Jewish faith had been building up to. People who were Jewish who had not accepted Jesus as the Messiah, however, they looked at that with scrutiny. And so what ended up happening was they would be slandered by people who were Jewish. They worshiped the same God, but because one group had accepted the Messiah and another had not, those who had not accepted the Messiah were saying, no, they don't belong to us. They're not the same thing as us. We worship one God. We don't worship Jesus. We don't worship the Son of God, Jesus. And so it led to this persecution kind of internally that was causing difficulty for the people in the early church. In Smyrna particularly, there was an issue where the prominent Jewish synagogue was slandering their beliefs and slandering who they were, and it was causing them to face persecution. It was causing them to face difficulties. And so Jesus says these words to them. Do not be afraid of what you are about to suffer, I tell you. The devil will put some of you in prison to test you, and you will suffer persecution for 10 days. The reality that Jesus wants the church in Smyrna to know is that they are going to face trials. Trials will come in life. They are going to face persecution. They are going to face difficulty. Now, for many of us, we hear trials, we hear difficulties, and there is a myriad of things that we might think of when we think of the trials we might face. This specifically deals with the trials that are encountered when you experience persecution. And you might think to yourself, that's something maybe that we don't wrestle with as much, but I believe that these letters, this is kind of the big idea we're looking at within the series, I believe that these letters in Revelation, the different churches and the different situations that they were experiencing, relate to what we experience within our faith today. So how does this relate to us? Now, if you happen to be a list writer, you like bullet points, you like things that are methodical and laid out well, if you are the type of person in this congregation who sits there from Sunday to Sunday and go, if Anthony tells one more story, I'm going to pull my hair out. Today, a few people sheepishly laughing behind me in the choir loft, today is your lucky day. Because we have not one but two lists for you list takers and you note takers. These are what I would say are the ways that people experience persecution today. As we look at the global church, as we look at what we experience today within the church as persecution, these are the types of persecution that are experienced. First of all, there is what we would know as violent persecution. That is what undoubtedly the people in Smyrna were afraid of. They were afraid of the violent kind of persecution that would come, possibly even leading to death. I've got a couple of images of some old artwork. One is kind of a hard to make out scene, but it is the stoning of Stephen. Stephen is there in the bottom right of the left image, and he's got kind of like the halo around him. And Stephen, his story is recorded in Acts chapter 6 and 7. And in chapter 7 of Acts, he becomes the first martyr following the death and resurrection of Jesus. He was martyred for his faith, for being outspoken, for proclaiming the resurrection, proclaiming the truth about Jesus. And he ended up being martyred. Now, as he's being martyred, Acts chapter 7, you can go read it later, tells this beautiful story about how he prayed for the people who were stoning him. Just as Jesus had prayed, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do, when he was dying on the cross, Stephen does exactly the same thing. And the part above him in that image is the image he saw of heaven opening and welcoming him in as he suffered his martyrdom for Christ. Now, the guy on the right, that's Polycarp. Now, just so you know, in a lot of older art forms, people who are saints are kind of denoted by this halo around their head. When I first looked at this picture, I thought he had a really awesome looking sombrero, but that is in fact a halo designating him as a saint. So Polycarp was actually the Bishop of Smyrna. So this church that this letter in Revelation is written to would have been written to the church that he oversaw. He may have even been the bishop. We don't know the dates exactly, but he may have even been the bishop of Smyrna at the time that this was written. He was a disciple of the apostle John who had written the book of Revelation, and he ends up being martyred around 154 AD for standing up for his Christian faith, probably a continuation of the church that this was written to. And as he is martyred, he was asked time after time after time to renounce his faith in Jesus. And he kept saying, God has never let me down. I will not let him down in this moment. And he stood firm in his faith and ended up dying for his faith. Now, what's incredible about the story of Polycarp is Polycarp, ended up that he was burned at the stake, which meant that he would be bound to a stake and then burned alive. But as he was being burned, the fire would not consume him. His faith was that strong that the fire would not consume him. They ended up being more gruesome. They ended up stabbing him to death. But he died for his faith. Now, the reality is that we go back to our list. The first type of persecution that people in the church experience today is violent. We don't see that much of it, fortunately, here in the United States, but around the world, as recently as 2020, it was estimated that around 160,000 people are martyred for their faith each year around the globe. I've got friends in some countries where other religions are more prominent. And in their country, it is a constant fear for them that violence might take their life, that they might experience persecution and end up losing their life because of their faith. But yet they stand strong, they stand firm. Now, what are we called to do in the midst of that? That's one of those where we kind of look at it and we might feel a little helpless. Well, we can lift them up in prayer. I believe a part of our prayer should always be praying for those who are persecuted for their faith, and praying for their protection, and praying for their hope in the midst of it. Beyond that, we can invest in missions that engage in those areas and support the efforts to try and spread the gospel so that they end up shifting beyond being the minority to being the majority and being triumphant in the midst of that. The second one, though, is one that would also probably be a part of those particular areas, is there are areas where there is legal persecution. There are different countries around the world where it is illegal to follow the Christian faith. And in those communities, it would be illegal to follow Jesus, and you would be persecuted from the government standpoint for having a Christian faith. Now, what's incredible is the gospel is growing tremendously around the world in the places where it's not legal. Imagine that. God doing amazing things in the shadows, doing amazing things despite the fact that it's not even legal to call upon the name of Jesus in those places. Again, we can pray, we can lift them up, and we can support the ministries that help to spread the gospel within those places. Now, the third is one that is kind of more prominent in areas where it is legal. We would call this kind of the familial or communal persecution, where it might be legal to follow Jesus, but it is not accepted within your family or within your community. I remember when I visited Thailand several years ago, that was something that was really a big difficulty for Christian missionaries in Thailand, is that being a Buddhist was so much a part of the Thai culture that it was frowned upon, and there would be so much social pressure from within your family and within your community if you converted to the Christian faith that many people would not stand firm in their faith. They would possibly convert to Christianity and then would renounce it later because of all of the family pressure. Because essentially, if you were to step out of the Buddhist faith, it was as though you were kind of turning your back on your family. And so in those communities, in those countries, those cultures, there is difficulty of persecution kind of from within your own family, within your community, if you do not follow the cultural expectations of the community. The fourth one, though, is one that I think we do wrestle with within our culture today and within the American context, and it's cultural persecution, where it becomes difficult to stand up for the Christian values. It becomes difficult to stand up in the midst of all of the different competing voices and mindsets within the world in which we live in. The cultural pressure can become a form of persecution that makes it difficult to remain Christian. And it makes it difficult to stand firm upon what we know to be the truth. Now, the fifth one kind of builds off that, and it's economic persecution. There are some places, not so much here in the American South, but there are some places where the cultural persecution makes it economically limiting if you are a Christian, where you might, if you are a Christian, your business may not be engaged with, you might not get the support from the community because of the values on which you stand. Here, it tends to be a little bit more of the opposite, but there are places where that economic persecution is a reality. But then this last one is one that I think that is subtle to the point that we may not even realize it, and it's what I would call internal persecution. Internal persecution is the limitation we place on ourselves, the lack of confidence to boldly proclaim our faith, the lack of confidence to stand up to the cultural persecution or economic persecution, or maybe even familial or communal persecution, but that internal limitation that we place on ourselves where we're not willing to proclaim our faith, we're not willing to speak it boldly and to let it be something that we're known by, that can be a limitation that we place on ourselves, and it becomes kind of another layer of persecution. Now, I promised two lists, and I want to share with you that the second list is how I think the Bible calls us to stand in the face of persecution. If you encounter trials in your life, if you encounter a sense of there is persecution that I am experiencing and I need to know how to stand up for my faith in the midst of it, there are five things that I think that the scriptures tell us repeatedly, and they're kind of highlighted in a few different areas. But as we look at the New Testament, these are the five ways that we are called to stand and face persecution. Number one, stand firm. As we read Ephesians chapter 6, that's the image of the armor of God, we are told over and over again to stand firm in the midst of attacks, to stand firm in the midst of persecution. Kenji did a wonderful sermon on that idea not too long ago. You can go and look it up if you missed it. But the idea is that when you encounter persecution, when you encounter trials, the very first thing that we are called to do is to stand firm in the midst of it. And standing firm just simply means knowing what you believe and standing with confidence in the midst of it. That is the foundation of facing any challenge we might find in our life, that we would stand firm, that we would stand up in the midst of it. Now, the second thing is kind of similar to that, and it is to speak boldly. Before the stoning of Stephen, going back a few chapters in Acts chapter 4, Peter and John had gotten into some trouble by healing a man at the temple. They ended up being questioned by the Jewish religious leaders. And then as their lives were threatened, the believers gathered together for prayer. And you know what they prayed for? Boldness. They prayed for more boldness. And then it says they began to speak the word of God boldly. In the midst of persecution, in the midst of difficulty, in the midst of being told to be silent, they still chose to speak boldly the name of Jesus and the power of his way. Now, the third thing is a little more difficult for us, and it is that in the midst of persecution, Jesus calls us to choose love. In Matthew chapter 5, that's a part of the Sermon on the Mount, we encounter Jesus with many calls for how to face persecution, how to kind of approach the world differently. And that chapter culminates with a section where he calls upon people to love their enemies. And within that, part of loving your enemy is to pray for those who persecute you. Now, what happens when you pray for someone who persecutes you, when you choose to show love towards someone who is slandering you, who is possibly bringing hate upon you? Romans chapter 12 describes it this way, pulling from an old proverb. It says it's as though you are putting hot coals on top of someone's head. That would be kind of a jarring experience to have hot coals put on top of your head. But that image is what it feels like when you respond to someone who is bringing hate upon you. You respond to them with love and prayer instead. And that's the way that Jesus called us to live. That in the face of difficulties, in the face of those who might bring harm upon us, that we would choose love and we would choose to pray and lift up those who are bringing the persecution and the hatred against us. The fourth thing is that we are called to stay together. We are called to stay together. Many of the New Testament letters, and even this here in Revelation, it's written to churches that were facing persecution. And within the writings of the New Testament, over and over again, there's a call to stay together, to stick together, to stay faithful to the course, and to keep lifting up and living within the community of God. Hebrews chapter 10 says it so beautifully. It says, do not give up on the habit of meeting with one another. Instead, spur one another on to good works with love. The call of staying together is why when we do our membership vows, which last week we had a few families and some confirmands join the church. You can join the church whenever you want to, if you want to let me know if you want to join the church. But when we take our membership vows, when you join the church, part of those vows is that we would support the church with our presence. We think of that as a way that we support the church by being here. But really, it's a way that the church is able to support us. when we come together in worship, when we sing the songs of praise together, when you hear the people around you singing, "Blessed Assurance, Jesus is mine," those words resonate and those words are an opportunity to share our faith and to celebrate that commitment with one another. And there's power in staying together and experiencing, whether it's in worship, whether it's in a small group setting, in a Bible study, Sunday school, all of those environments that we experience with the community are designed to help us stay together and to stay and to stand firm in our faith when we face trials within our lives. And then finally, the last one is that we wait expectantly. 2 Corinthians chapter 4 talks about this, anticipating the life to come, anticipating the resurrection to come. And you know, we don't have time in a seven-week sermon series to go through the entire book of Revelation, but I'm going to give you a little bit of a spoiler alert. If you want to read to the end of Revelation, the very end of the Bible, you know what the final part of it is? God wins. God wins. I mean, you can read the Bible backwards and forwards, and you know what you're going to learn? God wins. God's in control. God has the whole thing in his hand, and God wins. And we, as people of God, can stand firm in our faith. We can speak boldly of our faith. We can choose to be people of love. We can stay together and stay united because we have the opportunity to wait expectantly that even though we might face trials in this life, we know that there is a resurrection to come. We know that God is the one who was dead and now is alive. And because he is once dead and is now alive, we are called to live into that same new life as well and that same eternal promise. And Jesus says it this way to the church in Smyrna. Picking up in the middle of verse 10, he says, "Be faithful even to the point of death, and I will give you life as your victor's crown." Be faithful even to the point of death, and I will give you life as your victor's crown. Now, that image of the victor's crown, one of the things that would have been prominently known about Smyrna is that Smyrna had this hill that surrounded the city. And what they did, the people who laid out the city, is they built some of their most prominent structures on that hill to the form where it looked like there was a crown surrounding the city. So Jesus is saying, you're going to see the crown. You're going to see the victory. You may not see it in this life, but you know that the victor's crown is in that image is something that awaits you. And he says these words to them, "Whoever has ears, let them hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who is victorious," he's talking about them. He's talking about people who hold on to the promise. "The one who is victorious will not be hurt at all by the second death." Jesus lets them know they'll encounter trials in life, but victory will come as well. Trials will come, but so will victory. And that is the hope that we live into. That is the hope that we proclaim. That is the hope that enables us to stand firm and to put our trust and our hope when we face difficulties, when we face persecution, when we face something that might come against our faith and come against our lives. One of my favorite preachers is one I never really got the chance to hear in person, but I've been influenced by his recordings and by his writings. There's a guy by the name of Fred Craddock, and he was really prominent in the last century, and he died a little over 10 years ago. And Fred Craddock had grown up in the Appalachian Mountains, and he learned from his father and his father's friends, the older men within his community, the power of storytelling. And he learned from them that kind of that witty, kind of folksy Appalachian storytelling, and it became kind of a staple of his preaching. But he had a difficulty in his life. His father looked down upon his Christian faith. His father, it was kind of like a familial persecution that he experienced. His father, even though he credits to him that he learned that good storytelling, his father was very, very critical of the fact that he would choose to follow Jesus. He thought it was all kind of nonsense, the whole church thing and everything. But his father had this saying that was, you know, what's your story? Tell me your story. And as he was getting later in his life, having watched his son Fred grow up, still proclaiming boldly, despite his father's objection, proclaiming the truth and the hope of the resurrection and of the gospel. His father became very ill and got to the point where he could no longer talk. And Craddock tells a story that as he was there with his father when he was in the hospital, he looked over at his father and he could tell he was trying to say something. And he looked at his dad and he said, "What's your story, Dad? What's the story that you have to tell?" And his father motions for a pen and a piece of paper. And he just wrote down very simply, "I was wrong." And he held it up and showed it to Fred. Fred Craddock, in the midst of his life, in the midst of a father who told him that what he was proclaiming was nonsense, he just kept on speaking it. Because there was a hope that eventually his dad would hear the message. And for us, what we face in life, we're not called to know how the story is going to end for other people, but we are called to keep proclaiming with our lives the message of hope over and over and over again, choosing to be people of love, choosing to be people who stand firm, choosing to be people who speak boldly, choosing to be people that in the face of persecution say, "My eyes are fixed on the victory and I know how the story ends." Even if we don't know how all the details are going to fall into place, we serve a God who has promised us that kind of hope for our lives.